It's such an honor and a pleasure to introduce Christian Wiman to all of you tonight. For those not familiar with his work, Chris is an American poet and essayist, born in 1966 and raised in West Texas. He graduated from Washington and Lee University here in Virginia and has taught at Northwestern, Stanford University, Lynchburg College, the Prague School of Economics, and in 2003 he became editor of Poetry Magazine, which is the poetry magazine of the English-speaking world. And that position he just left to start teaching at Yale this fall. His books include poetry selections such as The Long Home, Hard Night, and Every Riven Thing, along with two books of prose, a collection of essays called Ambition and Survival, and the book most of you probably are here to hear him talk about tonight, My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer. I wanted to say just a little bit about that book. One of the passages that I've thought a lot about recently comes from the American writer and playwright Thornton Wilder. And he had this to say in the midst of the Great Depression: "The revival in religion will be a rhetorical problem, new persuasive words for defaced or degraded ones." And I think that quote really connects to Chris's work what Chris's work does is he makes the skeptic confront uncomfortable possibilities. He makes the doubter doubt even his doubt. And he makes the believer realize how much of what passes for faith is idolatrous nonsense, evasions, and wishful thinking. In short, Wiman's work, and this book in particular, My Bright Abyss, I think is the beginning of a conversation we very much need to have. And he clears away so much of the accumulated ridiculousness that has grown up around discussions of religion in this country. He clarifies the questions we should be asking more than he offers solutions. So I hope tonight, no matter where you're at and you're thinking about these matters, Chris's lecture will be a chance to begin a conversation. And with that, please welcome him.
When you consider the radiance, that it does not withhold itself, but pours its abundance without selection into every nook or cranny, not overhung or hidden. When you consider that birds' bones make no awful noise against the light, but lie low in the light as in a high testimony, when you consider the radiance, that it will look into the guiltiest swervings of the weaving heart and bear itself upon them, not flinching into disguise or darkening, when you consider the abundance of such resource as illuminates the glow-blue bodies and gold-skeined wings of flies swarming the dumped guts of the natural slaughter or the coil of shit, and in no way winces from its storms of generosity. When you consider that air or shale, snow or vacuum, squid or wolf, rose or lichen, each is accepted into as much light as it will take, then the heart moves roomier. The man stands and looks about. The leaf does not increase itself above the grass, and the dark work of the deepest cell is of a tune with May bushes and fear, lit by the breath of such, calmly turns to praise. Thank you to Christ Church and Mockingbird Ministries for having me here. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, David. Thanks, T. Teague, who's an old classmate who's essentially responsible for getting me here and helped with it. And thanks, Matt, for that wonderful introduction. I begin with that poem by A.R. Ammons, not by me, unfortunately, but by A.R. Ammons, for a couple of reasons. I'm going to talk a lot about art and faith, particularly Christianity, and the word art is like the word faith in one crucial sense. If you use it abstractly for any length of time, it's completely leached of its meaning. So I wanted to foreground a poem for us, and I'll return to poems. This is a very small little thing up here. Just drop them. The second reason is that while The City Limits, that's the name of that poem, feels like a religious poem, feels in fact as if it could be an incarnational Christian poem, the fact is Ammons had no religious belief at all and could be especially caustic about its Christian manifestations. And that's another thing that I'm going to touch on, what an art of faith might look like in the apparent absence of faith. Ammons represents a phenomenon in modern thought which is by this point pretty familiar. He's what you might think of as an unbelieving believer. He wouldn't believe in anything beyond the material world at all were it not for the insights that he's been given in his own life and poetry. Yet by means of these insights, or spots of time, as William Wordsworth was inclined to call them, it becomes possible to live and even to praise. The great Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel defined faith as primarily faithfulness to a time when we had faith. We remember those moments of intensity and closeness to God, and we endeavor to remain true to them. It's a tenuous, tenacious discipline of memory and hope. There are theologians who've seen their practice similarly. Here's Karl Barth. Theology knows the light which is intrinsically perfect and reveals everything in a flash, yet it knows it only in the prism of this act, which, however radically it may be understood, is still a human act. And then Barth goes on to talk about how limited this act is and how distinct theology, or thinking about God, is from divine revelation. Most poets that I know would not draw this distinction. And Barth would say they're headed straight to hell. Christianity and art, then. Let me start with that. And these are subjects about which I never stop thinking. My whole life seems to be obsessed with them. Since, after all, I call myself a Christian and an artist, it may be that by the time I'm finished, you have your doubts about both. But I do call myself those things. The great paradox of art for the artist is that the very art in which he feels experience most intensely can require a kind of severe detachment from experience. You feel most intensely in your work precisely that which you have failed to feel in your life. Perfection of the life or perfection of the work, as the great Irish poet W.B. Yeats put it. You've got to choose. If that fiery beauty Maud Gunn, whom Yeats loved so much, only reciprocated the great poet's passion, he might have, quote, thrown poor words away and been content to live. This tension between art and life, or imagination and experience, can be particularly rending when thinking about religious artists. Two famous examples from poetry are Gerard Manley Hopkins and George Herbert. I'm sure you know both of them. Hopkins was a Catholic priest, and he actually renounced poetry for period of 7 years. His reason was that poetry wasn't consistent with the seriousness of his vocation. But you don't need to read a lot of Hopkins to realize that the real reason was that the intensity of his creative experience competed with the intensity of his religious experience, and he felt himself presented with a very stark choice. "My own heart let me more have pity on," he writes in a late poem when he's pretty exhausted with the struggle. "Let me live to my sad self hereafter kind." I've always found that to be a very poignant and piercing prayer. "My own heart, let me more have pity on." Maybe because it's not one that I think to pray. But perhaps we all should. George Herbert, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare, also wrestled with this. Like Hopkins, Herbert was a priest, though he was an Anglican. That's funny. I met Matt Sittman last week, actually, in New York. We recorded a podcast at Andrew Sullivan's apartment. And at one point, Andrew Sullivan shook his head and said, "He's Catholic." And at one point he shook his head and said, you know, the thing he could never understand about the Church of England is why in the world would God care about England? It's a good question. The trouble for Herbert was that despite the fact that every poem he wrote was religious, he was conscious of some secular element at the very heart of making art, some anarchic and essential energy himself that faith, as he understood it, required him to subdue or curtail or limit. His poems are full of this tension and anguish, and you can feel it sometimes even in poems that aren't explicitly about this tension. Ah, my dear angry Lord, since thou dost love, yet strike, cast down, yet help afford, sure I will do the like. I will complain, yet praise. I will bewail, approve, and all my sour sweet days I will lament and love. Isn't that beautiful? The clear expression of mixed feelings, Auden once called poetry. It's why poetry of some sort is so essential to any unified religious life, and why the bastardizations of the Bible that erase the poetry for the sake of clarity are so wrong-headed and dreary. The clear expression of mixed feelings. What could be more necessary for the muddle of modern religious experience and life? And all my sour, sweet days, I will lament and love at the same damn time. I've always responded deeply to these two poets, but I've never experienced the tension between art and God in quite the same terms. There's a quote I came across recently from the Scottish runner Eric Liddell. His story is told in that movie Chariots of Fire, in which he explains why he can't give up running, not yet at any rate, to go and be a missionary in China. And Liddell says, I believe that God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. To give up running would be to hold him in contempt. I like this notion. God doesn't give a gift without giving an obligation to use it. How one uses it, though, that's where things get pretty complicated. I spoke some at a luncheon today about becoming a poet and the kind of maniacal obsessiveness that can require of people, and certainly it required of me. I arranged my entire life in order to facilitate the writing of poems. I took cruddy jobs. I moved constantly because that seemed in some way to fuel my work. I got it in my head that it fueled my work. I, at one point, moved 40 times in 15 years. I guess you just call yourself homeless at that point. In one of those years, I was living in Prague, and it was right after the revolution, and I was living with someone at the time, and we lived in one of those grim, gray apartment blocks that surround so many Eastern European cities, panelaks, they're called in Czech, and we had this tremendous view of Prague for about $25, $35 a month. I forget exactly what it was, but it was dirt cheap in any event. It's not possible anymore. One day, when I was studying Czech at the kitchen table and my girlfriend was taking a bath in the other room, a falcon landed on the windowsill. It was quite literally maybe 3 feet from me. A decade later, not long after that woman and I had gone our separate ways, I wrote this poem. It took me 10 years for the poem to actually emerge. It's called Poštolka, which in Czech means falcon, or more accurately, kestrel. When I was learning words and you were in the bath, there was a flurry of small birds. And in the aftermath of all that panicked flight, as if the red dusk willed a concentration of its light, a falcon on the sill. It scanned the orchard's bowers, then pane by pane it eyed the stories facing ours, but never looked inside. I called you in to see, And when you steamed the room and naked next to me stood dripping as a bloom of blood formed in your cheek and slowly seemed to melt, I could almost speak the love I almost felt. Wish for something, you said. A shiver pricked your spine. The falcon turned its head and locked its eyes on mine. And for a long moment, I'm still in. I wished and wished and wished the moment would not end. And just like that, it vanished. This is a love poem by a person who's incapable of love in some way. It's a rapture of time by someone who never quite enters time. It's a celebration of life by a man whose mind is tuned only to elegies. It is also, I believe, in a peculiar and very modern sense, a devotional poem, a poem to God, or at least an unconscious attempt at one, though God is nowhere present in it. That's what makes it modern. I was raised in a very religious atmosphere. It was in far west Texas, and the milieu, if I can use that word for that place, was charismatic, fundamentalist in a kind of automatic way. This was before the culture wars, visceral and very intense. I have no memory of meeting a real-life atheist until I went away to college, when a dauntingly hip and prep-schooled freshman announced his atheism to me as casually as a culinary preference. And in all honesty, I could not have been more surprised and terrified if he had begun swiveling his head around and growling Aramaic. My faith fell away, or it seemed to, under the pressure of the books I began to read, and for a long time I lived apart from God. And not simply apart from God, but as that poem Pushtolka reveals all too clearly, apart from the world. Like many modern artists, the energy in my art seemed to come from this very distance. That energy was often a despairing one, well, that just seemed to me what modern art was. I wasn't an atheist, not at all. I was more someone fiercely devoted to his lack of faith, or fiercely devoted to a faith that had no object, either in this world or any other. Sumptuous destitution, in Emily Dickinson's fantastic phrase. Without my loneliness, I would be more lonely, writes Marianne Moore. So I keep it. I bet you know what I'm talking about. You don't have to be an artist for that. We all treasure our miseries to some extent, as we talked about at lunch today. There's a great passage in Paradise Lost. I think of those devils in the second book of Paradise Lost. One of them stands up and says, "Why not just stay here? Our torments also may in length of time become our elements. These piercing fires as soft as now severe, our temper changed into their temper, which must needs remove the sensible of pain. We'll get used to it. Just stay here. There's no pain that you can't befriend." It took some serious events to shatter my notions of myself and my art. I don't have time or the inclination to go into all of it in detail. It's in my books. I don't mean for that to be an advertisement so much as it's more of a deflection. I've spent a lot of time talking about myself recently, and I've discovered that I find myself finitely interesting. Here's the short version. Poetry, after being the main focus of my adult life for 2 decades, went dead in me for a number of years, for 3 years, and I couldn't write a word. I fell in love in a way that I knew immediately was both primal and permanent. And I got a terrible diagnosis of a cancer that couldn't be cured, which demanded some radical changes in the way that I live. All these experiences were, weirdly, one experience in me. It took a while, but I eventually got it through my thick head what that experience was. It was the call of God. Here then is another poem called From a Window. It was written sometime after all of the experiences that I have related to you, and written in one quick, consuming, and mysterious burst that seemed so utterly of my own mind and yet so little under my control that I couldn't tell if it came from inside or outside of me. Incurable and unbelieving in any truth but the truth of grieving, I saw a tree inside a tree rise kaleidoscopically as if the leaves had livelier ghosts. I pressed my face as close to the pain as I could get to watch that fitful, fluent spirit that seemed a single being, undefined, or countless beings of one mind, haul its strange cohesion beyond the limits of my vision over the house heavenwards. Of course, I knew those leaves were birds. Of course, that old tree stood exactly as it had and would, but why should it seem fuller now? And though a man's mind might endow even a tree with some excess of life to which a man seems witness, that life is not the life of men. And that is where the joy came in. Nothing in this poem was planned. That is, I didn't begin to have the realization that an experience of reality can open into an experience of God and then go write a poem to illustrate my feelings. It was quite the reverse. I wrote the poem one day out of anguish, emptiness, grief, all the emotions that had animated poems like Postolka, and it exploded into joy. Here's another poem written about the same time as From a Window. It's called For D. D is my wife. Groans going all the way up a young tree, half cracked and caught in the crook of another. Pause. All around the hill-ringed, heavened pond, leaves shush themselves like an audience. A cellular stillness, as of some huge attention bearing down. May I hold your hand? A clutch of mayflies banqueting on oblivion writhes above the water like visible light. Surely we have all had moments like this in one form or another. Moments when all the vacant interstellar spaces and random atoms around us seem to perceive wonderfully, terribly, us, each of us, right down to the very last cell of our singularity. One of those moments when oblivion whispers in our ears, when it seems, in fact, not oblivion, if by oblivion we mean only an end to everything we know and love and are. You could call it God. You could call it being, or maybe mind in some utterly de-individualized sense. Or you might not care to call it anything at all. Both these poems were watersheds for me, radical influxes of life beyond my own. They felt altogether different from my earlier work. And that's why in the months and the years that followed, I was a bit puzzled and concerned by some of the poems that came after, which felt as if they emerged from that same tangle of anguished joy, but seemed to end at very different places. A couple of my Christian friends were actively disturbed by the work because it seemed to be a regression of sorts. I actually shudder to think of them reading my next book, which is... An interviewer once asked me, not that long ago actually, asked me if I considered myself an atheist Christian. It's certainly true that some of the latter poems have the loving particularity of detail that is in that poem for my wife, but not its invocation of a beyond. It's true that they have the same all-in-one burst sort of fluency and feeling of from a window, but not quite its faith. Faith there is, I think, though admittedly of a starkly mortal sort. It is good to sit even a rotting body in sunlight, uncompromised by God or lack of God. To see the bee beyond all the plundered flowers, air stagger toward you and like a delicate helicopter hover above your knee until it finds you to be not sweet, but at least not flinching. Its hair legs on the hair of your leg, silvering a coolness through you like a soul of nerve. Or consider this one, called Hammer is the Prayer. There is no consolation in the thought of God, he said, slamming another nail in another house another havoc had half taken. Grace is not consciousness, nor is it beyond. To hell with remembrance, to hell with heaven. Hammer is the prayer of the poor and the dying. And as wind in some lordless random comes to rest, and all the disquieted dust within, peace came to the hinterlands of our minds. Too remote to know, but peace nonetheless. Not only is there no God in these poems, the very possibility of God is pushed roughly to the side. And yet, mirabilic dictu, I felt God everywhere in me and around me when I wrote them. There is no possibility of heaven in these poems. Indeed, there's open contempt for the notion. And yet I felt during that brief marriage of word and world that poetry is, projected into dimensions of existence I could never have imagined before writing the poems. I don't mean to be making special claims for these poems. If you show me a poet who's convinced of his own achievement, I will show you a fool. But I do want to offer them up as illustrations of what I've come to think of as anti-devotional, devotional poems. Hopkins and Herbert both felt that God circumscribed imagination, that faith required drawing certain lines inside of their own minds which they dared not cross. I understand the dilemma, but disagree with the solution. If faith requires you to foreclose on an inspiration, it is not faith. I hasten to add, though, that if despair forces you to foreclose on an inspiration, if despair, absence, and emptiness become the only track down which art's elated train of thoughts can travel, then that is finally a stunted and perhaps even diabolical version of art. I don't see, then, any of these poems that I've read in simple opposition to each other. I am convinced that the same impulse that leads me to sing of God leads me to sing of godlessness. God would have us know that we must live as men who manage our lives without him, says Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who goes on, the God who lets us live in the world without the working hypothesis of God is the God before whom we stand continually. Before God and with God, we live without God. Clearly, then, the question of exactly which art is seeking God and seeking to be in the service of God is much more complicated than it might seem. There is something in all original art that will not be made subject to God. If we mean by being made subject to God a kind of voluntary censorship or willed refusal of the mind's spontaneous and sometimes disturbing intrusions into and extensions of reality. But that's not how that phrase ought to be understood. In fact, we come closer to the truth of the artist's relation to divinity, and not just the artist, to people's relation to divinity. If we think not of being made subject to God, but of being subjected to God, our individual subjectivity being lost and rediscovered within the reality of God, no matter what your action is, whether it's doing woodwork or taking care of the poor or loving your children or loving your husband, whatever it is, some action in which we are so engrossed and lost that we rediscover our subjectivities, we lose our subjectivities within the subjectivity of God. Human imagination is not simply our means of reaching out to God, but God's means of manifesting himself to us. It follows that any notion of God that is static is not simply sterile, but since it asserts singular knowledge of God and seeks to limit his being to that knowledge, blasphemous. God's truth is life, as the poet Patrick Cavanaugh says, even the grotesque shapes of its foulest fire. One part of that truth, for even the most devout among us, is the void of godlessness. And, this is crucial and bizarre, the joy of that void. What I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that sometimes God calls a person to unbelief in order that faith may take new forms. Let me end with one poem that might give you some sense of how all this has played out for me and in me relatively recently. I wrote it during one long, anguished night when, to quote my old companion George Herbert, my thoughts were all a case of knives. There's a lot of background context to this poem, but again, I'm reluctant to fill it in too minutely. Context gets burned away, for one thing, if a poem is any good at all. But also, this particular context damn near burned me away altogether, and I still find the memory smoldering. Suffice it to say that I was sick unto death. In the Kierkegaardian sense, yes, sick in my soul, but also quite literally, I was dying. It has been my own experience that the reason why there are no atheists in foxholes, so to speak, is not because of the roar of death and destruction that makes a person terrified, but because when one is truly confronted with one's death, everything goes icily quiet. You don't turn to God in a crisis because you are afraid, at least not primarily. You turn to God because for once all that background chatter in your brain, all that pandemonium of blab, ceases, and you can hear. And what some of us hear is a still, small voice. I have never felt a whit of comfort in the notion of heaven or eternity, mostly because I can't conceive of those things. During that podcast last week at Andrew Sullivan's place, at one point, Matt told me that he thought of Christianity as a scouring of the self, and most of our notions of eternity and or heaven amounted to nothing more than projections of or dreams of the self's survival, and were therefore idolatrous. This seems very wise to me, and yet, something in us does seem unkillable, doesn't it? We have those moments of banqueting on oblivion. We have our intimations of immortality, as Wordsworth called them. Here then is one of mine, though it occurs not in the bucolic Lake District, but on the miserable, overcrowded L line in North Chicago. I think it will be obvious when you hear the poem, but just to be sure, this is a packed train at rush hour, and all of the commuters turn to see one thing at the same time, a rooster tail of sparks. Grand is the name of the stop where the Poetry Magazine offices used to be, so that's where I was always getting off, at Grand. There's another stop mentioned in this poem, Clark and Division. The poem is called My Stop is Grand. I have no illusion, some fusion of force and form will save me. Bewilderment of bone light, ungrave me. as when the L shooting through a hell of ratty alleys where nothing thrives but soot, and the rat-like lives that have learned to eat it, screechingly peacocked a grace of sparks so far out and above the fast curve that jostled and fastened us into a single shock of, I will not call it love, but at least some brief and no doubt illusionary belief that in some surge of brain we were all seeing one thing, alone, unearned loveliness struck from an iron pane. Already it was gone. Already it was bone. The gray sky and the encroaching skyline pecked so clean by raptor night, I shuddered at the cold gleam we hurtled toward like some insentient herd plunging underground at Clark and Division. And yet all that day I had a kind of vision that's never gone completely away, of immense, clear-paned towers and endlessly expendable hours through which I walked teeming human streets, filled with a shine that was most intimately me and not mine. Thank you very much. Thank you.